Thanks. And so I'm Cathy and I'm an addict.
Hi, Cathy.
And I'm very nervous. And I seem to get more and more nervous doing chairs the longer I'm around. And I have been around a long time. And therefore, I think I should have all these wonderful words of wisdom to speak, which I don't think I really do have. And I, as I sort of think about what I say, I mean, I feel really sort of anxious, and that was how I felt all my life. I was like always very anxious, very shy, very self-obsessed, very self-conscious. And I can remember being told, I don't have the very early memories, that when I was about 2 or 3 years old, I would scowl at everybody. It was like, you know, sort of go away. I wasn't sort of friendly, outgoing or anything. And a lot of the time, sort of, very anxious. And I was quite overprotective by my mother because she'd get very anxious because I was anxious, sort of thing. And in that respect, you know, she'd kind of take over and take responsibility for me. So I didn't really learn a lot about some things about how to take responsibility for myself. I didn't learn how to do. The other thing I remember when I was young was like, I just never really knew what I wanted to do. I quite enjoyed school as I got older, and I sort of got into studying, and I sort of quite enjoyed that. And it was a kind of structure that I quite liked. I didn't really like the idea of becoming a woman, because although my mother worked, it was like she and the other role models, and my aunt, they seemed to be the ones that had to be sensible, responsible, bring up the children, while the men went off and raved out about and got drunk, had fun, and that sort of thing. And that didn't seem very good. Didn't really like that idea of getting married and having children and having to be responsible and living a boring life. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I was at a highly academic school, so that sort of thought, well, I'll go to university, because that puts off the evil hour of having to think about what you want to do. So I did that. I got to university and sort of, I suppose, in the first year did all the kind of right kind of things, but then found myself attracted to this beatnik kind of set, of course, who, you know, were using drugs. And got involved with this really horrible, creepy guy who was involved in that scene. And that became a pattern. I would sort of, people who would choose me and want to control me, I would get involved with, but I didn't really have any emotional connection with. The ones that I really liked or, you know, did have a connection, I could never stay with or was horrible to or whatever. So so eventually through that, I began using what was my first drug of choice, which was speed. And throughout, that was in the 60s, and by the end of the 60s, about 6 years later, having been inside, I was a third time in psychiatric hospital coming off speed, having sort of had phases on and off and changing jobs and trying to go straight and not knowing what the fuck I was doing or what I wanted to do. I ended up getting married to somebody that I didn't really trust, and I don't think trusted me, but it was like, it seemed like the right thing to do. And I can remember this psychiatrist I was under at the time, he said, are you sure this is just not another one of those things you're doing? And I never forgot that, because it was by that time, it was like my parents approved of this guy because he didn't take drugs and he drank, and this was like, okay. They were always encouraging me to drink, but I didn't like drink. And this was like normal. If you people drank, that was supposed to be not. They didn't realise that quite a few, like particularly Scottish addicts who I knew would drink as well as take drugs. But so anyway, that sort of, so I got married, had a daughter, and then I was sort of stuck. Then I had to get out of the marriage. My father died, which was really, I found very difficult to cope with. And then I was kind of stuck on my own with this child, not knowing what the fuck I was doing. At that point, I wasn't really using much at all, and apart from the sort of psychiatric drugs, which in Valium I had for years, you know, so I've been using those, and drink and taking lots of over-the-counter medication, handfuls of caffeine tablets. This was not using. So that was sort of my history. I was a real pill head. But then I got into back into heavily using, the heaviest using of my life was like really bang at the coke, all kinds of patent medicines, and eventually ending up fixing heroin, which I hadn't done before, and felt I was a failure because I hadn't. But I was terrified of taking heroin because I thought it'd make me throw up, and I had real phobia. I thought, what drug that's going to make me throw up and be sick, and it's the last thing I wanted to take. And I think I was a bit scared. But when I eventually tried it while I was sitting in a squat waiting to score some speed one night with a couple of women, you know, it didn't make me sick, and I felt fine. It was really nice. I thought, this is okay. Off you go, sort of thing, you know. But I ended up, in the end, after this sort of really heavy phase of using, destroying everything. I had a business with my mother, destroyed that. I couldn't look after my daughter, my mother took her away, and I just kind of collapsed and ended up in psychiatric hospital yet again. Really completely shot to pieces. And after that, I was sort of like farmed out to different members, because I had a house, a flat in my mother's house. I was farmed out to different members of the family, and I didn't know what the fuck, you know. I was kind of, I had hepatitis, and anyway, in the end, I started to go and come back to London and hit the West End and score, and I thought, no, I can't do this. So actually, I went to a social worker that I'd heard of months, you know, earlier in the year, and she referred me to go into a rehab, and people have probably heard about these really heavy rehabs. Well, I spent at least a year, but it was really, it saved my life. It was like a really tough place, and lots of people left the whole time. People came and went left, right and centre, but I think at that point I was really desperate, and I knew if I didn't stick it out, I had nowhere to go. I'd be back on the street and I'd be dead. And lots of people did leave there, go back on the street and die, because they were also told, you know, if you don't stick it out here, you'll go down the Dilly, you'll shoot up and you'll die. It was very tough, and it was kind of replicated, I think, a lot of people's families, in that, you know, it was very caring on the one hand, but extremely abusive on the other hand. But I think to get through it, I sort of learned how to play the game in a way, like sort of... we had all these really harsh encounter groups of people to shout and scream, and you had to be honest. Well, it was like, I didn't even know what that meant in the first place. I thought it was just not lying. But it was like, it was really, really pretty abusive. And so you had to sort of shout and scream, and then fall in a heap, and people would pick you back up together again. But as I say, because we had to learn how to take responsibility there, it was a community run by the residents. That was, you know, in that respect, we learned how to take responsibility and care for one another and run a sort of, you know, the house, every day-to-day running of the house, as well as caring for other people in a sort of emotional way as well. So that was something that I definitely benefited from. And I did go on afterwards to work there. The problem was, while I was there, was that they didn't regard alcohol as a drug. And even though, you know, we're all abstinent while we're in the program, in the final stages of the program, you're encouraged to drink. And I didn't want to, because I just thought, I never liked alcohol, and, you know, it seemed obvious to me, because I'd taken these different drugs, that if I, you know, I could easily switch. But I did end up drinking, because everyone was a wet blanket if I didn't, so I did that. And like everyone else, eventually that led me back to using. What I found about alcohol and drinking, there was one thing, which was like more that you, because it was socially acceptable, you know, you could kind of go to parties and be quite extrovert and have a good time, and in a way that I couldn't when I was on drugs, because I would just be, you know, out of it and didn't get, or talking a load of rubbish, I didn't even know what's going on. Although at the end of the evening of sort of being out, going out in somewhere and getting pissed, I think, what the fuck was all that about? You know, sort of talking all this rubbish all night long. And as I say, in the end, it took me back to using coke and other drugs for a time. But I didn't get in as much mess as prior to going to the rehab, you know, because I'd learned how to be more responsible, and I wasn't going to lose everything. So I was sort of working, unable to just about afford the drugs that I needed. Whilst I was in the rehab, my daughter was being looked after by my mother, and eventually I came back to live. I had to come back to live in the same house as my mother, where my daughter was, and start taking responsibility for her again. I worked in this rehab after I'd completed the program there, which lots of people did, and then after I left, I had this relapse. I went into working in other areas, and then I got back into working in the field, and also started doing a counselling training, and I dabbled with a bit of using, and everyone was drinking, you know, in this sort of situation. I wasn't in an abstinence-based program. I hadn't even heard about sort of abstinence-based treatment then. Although I did get introduced to NA whilst waiting with another guy from this rehab who'd relapsed. We were sitting in the kids' cafe in the King's Road about, I don't know, as you do, it was about midnight or 11 o'clock at night or something. And in comes one of the founder members of NA with this literature, which looks all a bit weird and like some kind of cultish American kind of whatever, and telling us about NA, which sounded to me like, oh. When I heard the word God, and I thought, you know, group, after the experience of this rehab, I thought, no, thank you very much. And it was like, also, because it was supposed to be so bad, if you relapse after the rehab, you were really sort of bad. I thought, oh my God, I can't cope with that. Put it in the back burner and sort of thing. But anyway, so, you know, eventually I got back into working in an agency, and I was, at this point, using, I think, work and studying to keep me clean. And I was actually about having the very odd drink, but wanting to be completely abstinent, when I met someone, a member of this fellowship, who was like a colleague working up the road from me, we work in the same business, and took me to a meeting. And I'd always say that, you know, I met two people at this meeting who I'd used with, and one of them had been so horrible when we were using. I couldn't believe when he smiled at me and gave me a hug. I thought, there's something going on here. And as I say, I realised that I did actually need something really if I was going to manage to stay clean ongoing basis, given my history of having, you know, continually sort of used on and off and then relapsed.
How much time have I got?
Yeah, you've got 25 minutes.
Oh, God. So that was my sort of introduction in coming into the rooms. And I, first of all, I was a bit arrogant. I thought, oh, well, you know, and also because I was working, and I was working in an agency. And, oh, yes, and one thing, it's like difficult to come in, because initially I thought, well, what happens if I see clients, you know, at a meeting? And I'd never really actually not disclosed that I was in, you know, because I called myself an ex-addict, and as long as I wasn't using drugs, alcohol didn't count, sort of thing. So I didn't, that didn't really present a problem in a way. And when I did come in and I did see clients at meetings, I didn't find it a problem because, as I say, I was open with people, and I just, so it was all right, although I had to maintain, I suppose, some kind of degree of boundaries, which meant that when I came in, because I wasn't at a rock bottom, as a lot of people are, I couldn't come, you know, to meeting every day because of my work, and I didn't sort of get involved with people as other people do, as I had, say, got close to people when I got in the rehab at my rock bottom. So it was a different, plus because I was working as a professional and a counsellor, there were very few people in the rooms in those days working as counsellors. Now it's loads of them. But there was, so in some ways, I was sort of pedestalised because I was this counsellor, and I could hide behind that role as well as, you know, being discussing at work, you know, the kind of boundaries we could be having with clients and things. It took me a while to kind of acknowledge that, you know, I sort of thought at first, oh, well, you know, I don't need to go to many meetings. I can go to one a week. I don't need a sponsor. I'll sail through the steps. And even though at the same time I was terrified, really nervous, I didn't know the serenity prayer. And, oh, my God, you know, I remember thinking I was sharing rubbish at meetings, but nobody ever laughed at me or told me I was stupid or anything else. I just said, keep coming back. And, you know, I had a group of people that I got close to. And then I thought, well, fuck it. Okay, if I'm going to get something out of this program, I need to kind of surrender. I need to get a sponsor. I need to work the steps. And so I did that, got commitment, and went from there. And I think all those slogans, keep coming back, you know, day at a time, keep it simple, easy does it. Well, I can't remember. Anyway, all those things were really important to me, and I used to sort of read them on the wall, and still are today. I found it, I did have a difficulty in some ways initially when I first came in, as well as I had to study all the stories in the back of the book to find somebody I could identify with. But I think what I did was get the idea that definitely, you know, if you're going, you stick with the winners, and, you know, you have to put your recovery first, keep coming to meetings, which I started to do, and work the steps, which I did too. And I think I was just thinking at the steps. I had this sponsor. I worked the steps and for quite a long time, and then got into being quite workaholic, and spending money. So my addiction would play out in other areas, and so. Also, because I got after I'd been, I think, 3 years in the rooms, I started working in a 12-step treatment, abstinence-based 12-step treatment. And, of course, most, you know, people went to meetings and so on. And but also I found working, if you work in the business, you know, and I think I had even had this when I worked at the rehab, there were a lot of professionals around who don't like 12-step. And so, you know, you're kind of in this area of hearing all this stuff from other professionals saying it's rubbish, it doesn't work, and all the kind of rest of it. And then also, you know, if, as being a professional, and I went on to do an MMC course at one point, but I'm thinking about working with people and seeing people in the rooms and people I've worked with, why do some people not get this? Why do people keep going out and relapsing? What's that about? You know, does this work for everybody? So, you know, and it's important to think about those things as a professional. But it can screw your head into like, well, but what about me? You know, I'm a recovering addict and I come to meetings and I need the meetings and I need this program. So I had to, and so I could go through lots of, and I think with other people who worked in the field, of criticizing the program and to some degree and questioning it. But at that point, I was still coming to meetings. And in the end, I just had to think, well, okay, there's that part of me that's a professional and I can look at it in this way and I can talk to other professionals about the validity of the program, why people might not be able to hack it or whatever else, and that there are other ways, definitely, and some people need to be on a script and stabilise before they're ready to sort of become abstinent. And, you know, but at the same time, I'm an addict and, you know, this program works for me and I need this program and I need to work it for myself. And it doesn't really matter why it works or why it doesn't work. I think that's the other thing. One can get into analysing it all, kind of why does it work or not work? And people have written papers on, you know, comparing it with this and that. Doesn't really matter to me. I don't believe particularly in the disease concept, and if that helps some people, fine, you know, but it's like something that I understand what addiction means to me, and addiction means to me is it's something like, I don't find life easy, I find it a struggle, I find it difficult to cope with how I feel about myself, about life, to take responsibility, always kind of felt kind of quite lost with what I'm doing, and this program, you know, helps me with that. I know that I'm an addict, whatever that means. I mean, I think a lot of what Myla was saying. And that's quite... I came in here tonight thinking, oh, my God, I'm really anxious. And, oh, God, what am I going to say? And I can't think of it. And the longer I'm around, it just seems, well, there's nothing much to say. And I've been around a long time. I still need to come to meetings. And I'm very grateful that this program was here. And if it wasn't here, I don't know how I'd cope. And then I bumped into two people that I've known a very long time and came around just after me. And they said that Milo was doing the chair, their son. And I thought, remember Milo, I don't want to embarrass you, but the day he was born. So it's all a bit crazy. So, you know, and it shows you that the program works, I suppose, and it's all bizarre, really, when I think about how long I've been around, you know, and how people can come in at all different ages, and how that is. I often think about whether if I'd come into the rooms 22, I think it was the first time I went into psychiatry hospital, whether I could have hacked it. I don't think I could, actually. I think I would have ended up sleeping with everybody and kind of getting completely... I think it's easy. I don't think this program is easy. I don't think it's easy to sort of open up and be honest with people and to know how to sort of take responsibility in that way. I don't know whether I could have done. And I think, you know, I didn't find it very easy to talk about myself very openly. And I still don't think I think that. I think I'll go back to the steps. I was just thinking, I think, about the steps, and people tell me, I don't not often share about the steps, but I was thinking, I remember when I first did step one, I think I had got, before I came into these rooms, I think I had quite an idea of powerlessness, stemming back from when I was at university quite early on, and I had failed exams, because I was using one, just not fucking about, and I was standing outside this exam room to resit the exam, and I'd been using speed to revise. My experience of using speed to pass exams was not good. So I'm standing there with dextrin spandrel in my hand thinking, well, if I take this, I won't probably pass the exam. If I don't take it, I might pass. But of course, I took it. And I failed the exam. So that sort of showed me that, well, you know, I was powerless over, you know, really doing anything sensible. And another time, I think, when I was decided to not use, I mean, I was probably on the Valium and stuff, and somebody offered me one pill. And I thought, oh, fuck. One pill's no good, you know. I don't want one pill. If I'm going to have, you know, I need more. So, and at that point, I wasn't kind of in the mood to kind of go and think I've got to go and score and get a constant supply. And a lot of the time, I used to get supplies from doctors anyway, because that was easier than sort of hassling around and more reliable than hassling on the black market or something. So I had an idea, you know, of what it meant being powerlessness in that way, and probably unmanageability, because my life was certainly pretty unmanageable in that, you know, I wouldn't take responsibility, everything would sort of go out the window, and I didn't, you know, got to the point where I couldn't look after my daughter or anything. So I knew about that, and but when I actually kind of really took on board what that was like, that sort of sense of surrendering to this kind of sense of being powerless over my addiction, it was kind of a horrible feeling. It was like kind of just feeling, you know, fuck, you know, very vulnerable and very helpless sort of thing. But fortunately, I think, then I kind of got this grasp of the step two aspect where, you know, there is hope. I can get help from the program, from my sponsor, from the steps, and a higher power. And at that point, I was sort of struggling and was exploring a lot around spirituality. I was doing this counselling training that was very much a sort of holistic and psycho-spiritual sort of programme, where we looked at sort of spirituality and what that meant and the sense of being part of something greater. And for me, I think I had always had, since childhood, a sense of connecting with nature. That had been my way of soothing myself. I didn't know any other ways. But if I got upset about things, or I would go off on my own and sit in the trees and listen to the wind, or go off on my bike, or go and sit by the water. So that was always something very soothing, and I reconnected with that. And I was doing some therapy, and that helped me to sort of get out of this black hole that I used to go into and find a sort of more sense of lightness. So I grasped this sense of a higher power, which varies, but it certainly is that something of being part of something greater and in the light rather than the dark. And step three, I think, is more about, make a decision, it's about letting go of the control. You know, I cannot control stuff. I cannot foresee and things are going to happen. I mean, I sort of describe it like sitting, you know, I stand at the bus stop, and I'm getting impatient for the bus to come, and I kick the bus stop. All that happens is I get a sore foot. It doesn't make the bus come. And it was kind of, that sort of seemed to me like I just need to let go. You know, I stand here, wait for the bus, and hope that it'll come sometime. But actually trying to force something doesn't make it come. And that sort of spelled it out for me. But it's a bit like, you know, I just have to trust the process. I think when we have to put in the footwork, but the results are up to whatever. My higher power. And it's difficult sometimes not to try and sort of force that, or have a false sort of sense of that signal means such and such, but just sort of trusting and that things will be okay. And that became clear to me particularly when my mother died, which was just over 10 years ago, and I found it so painful. I didn't believe, you know, I couldn't believe the amount of pain I felt. And that also entailed then having to sort of think about moving house and everything else. And I just was so painful. And I just couldn't, you know, it was like I would go out in the garden and sort of just pray and think, please, please, you know, help me just cope with this, how I'm feeling. And, you know, being able to go to meetings and to share and to get support from people, it sort of got me through. And I've always had that sort of sense of, you know, I can get through to the best of my ability, not perfectly, as long as I get through the day without picking up. And I think that was something else I got at the beginning of the programme. It's about the primary purpose is staying clean a day at a time. We always have to remember that, you know, as long as I can get through the day clean to the best of my ability, not perfectly, then that's a major achievement. One thing I picked up when I first came around was people used to say, oh, look, about a miracle. And I think that was like really, you know, all the time you'd hear one, you know, an addict one day clean is a miracle. And I think that was something that I really picked up on. And I think it is a miracle, all of us sitting in this room here clean, because a lot of people don't make it. You know, I know people that have gone out. A few, fortunately, have come back in. Some people I've known stop coming to meetings and not even actually pick up, but gone a bit bonkers and come back in. But some have gone back in, gone back out, unfortunately come back in, not having, you know, suffered too much. Others come back, go out, come back, go out, but they keep coming back. And others go out and sadly die, and don't come back. And sometimes I think, you know, we can get into thinking, well, why me? I remember thinking that quite a lot, particularly at that rehab. Why me? Why do I stay clean? You know, and why do other people not? But I can't answer that question. And steps 4, 5. I mean, I think some of the 4 I did in therapy as well. But that's just kind of a giving honest appraisal of who we are, being able to sort of look at objectively or sort of realistically about the, things that we've done or done, or about ourselves and about myself. And also the assets I found very difficult, and then being able to share that with another person who was accepting of what I shared and not judgmental. But I think for me after a long time, after a while I didn't have a sponsor, and then recently, about 6-7 years ago, I decided to get a sponsor again and work the steps again, because I'd sort of, although I was coming to meetings and had commitments, I didn't feel like I was really getting the full benefits of the program. I also decided to stop therapy, which I was in at that point, because I thought, actually, I've done so much therapy, which was really I needed to help with, but also I just thought, I need to learn how to use this program to help me, how to live my life on a daily basis. That's what I do, you know. I think more and more, I had a real sort of crash with my program just over about 12 years ago now, where I had to go right back to basics and just sort of get back to coming to meetings, keeping it simple, getting a Just for Today book, reading that every day, getting down on my knees at night and in the morning and praying and doing those simple basic things. And so I got a sponsor again and began to work the steps again. And I think what I found this time around is the most profound steps for me is like, well, those first 3, and then there's 4 and 5, and then 6 and 7, which I don't think I really understood the first time around. They get a bit confusing, and I don't like the word defects. I prefer to say sort of behaviour or character traits or whatever, because I think they both have a sort of positive and negative side to them, really. And it's just looking at our behaviours and looking at how maybe this isn't helpful, and how can I behave in a better and more constructive way that's not damaging to me or to other people. It's actually an ongoing process for me, those steps, and it's probably tied in with I suppose steps 10, 11 and 12 as well. But that actually how I found it was like, because it's like very sort of strange, you think, well, character defects, please remove them from me and everything else. And I think because I'd done all this therapy and everything else, I thought, I should have been able to change all this way of behaving. I should be sort of much better able to, do whatever, behave better, not get angry, not get impatient, not get irritable, not all these things, you know. So, But what I found was, and I still find, is more and more, I'm aware of certain aspects of my behaviour that I don't feel comfortable with. And it's like when I become aware and more and more uncomfortable with it, I just have to pray to actually ask my higher power to, if it's their will, to get to remove it. Because I can't do it myself. And don't ask me how that works, but somehow it does. Well, only in as much as it becomes less so. I think we don't ever change completely, maybe, some of those behaviours. And, you know, but they become less often. I can become more aware of it, apologise sooner. If I'm getting wound up, going, particularly when I'm going round London on the tube and all these people are getting in my way and wheeling their suitcases over my feet and I'm getting more and more uptight and they don't get out of my way. And I have to sometimes chill out. And it's not easy, but it's like, what is the point of getting uptight like that? But I do. So it's like, you know, gradually sort of trying to sort of feel a bit more comfortable with who I am. And I think that was, again, what I think this program has given me and what those steps do. And the whole way along, it's about accepting myself as I am, with all the warts and pimples. And I'm not perfect. And trying to be, trying to live my life to the best of my ability, in line with spiritual principles, and take responsibility, to try not to hurt or be unkind or uncaring towards people, though sometimes I might be. And also, you know, I've always feel for me, I have to keep coming to meetings. I try to go to at least 3 meetings a week and always to have a commitment, because the only time my program got really shaky was when I didn't have a regular meeting. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't working the steps. I didn't have any commitments. And so now I just keep it simple and do those things. And I keep coming back. And that's, you know, we only keep what we have by giving it away. And also, I need to hear, you know, I need to come to meetings to hear other people share, because I don't know, you know, I my head goes all over the place and I want to hear other people sharing stuff that's helpful for me. And I'm going to leave it there. So thanks very much.
Thank you.